1964. Here are the numbers right now. 13 degrees Racine, 10 Kenosha, 7 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind chill stands at zero. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's. 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Before we begin today's morning show, we want to remind you that today is the final day of Wisconsin Public Radio's fun drive, and if you would like to get in on the fun and express your appreciation for WGTD and all that you hear over Wisconsin Public Radio, we would urge you to take a moment to call toll-free 1-888-202-2552. 1-888-202-2552, or go to WPR.org. And please indicate that you're a listener to WGTD. If you happen to be a fan of the morning show, please say that as well. In these critical times in which we live, it's more important than ever that you convey your support and appreciation for public broadcasting in general and Wisconsin Public Radio and WGTD in particular with a pledge to the fund drive. So we hope you will do so, and we thank you for your support. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I am absolutely delighted to be beginning the week with Craig Swanson, and a familiar name to many of you as editor of the Kenosha News for many, many years, and now an author of a couple of different books. Previously, a book called Something in the Air, Rock Music and Cultural Upheaval in Mid-1960s America, and more recently, a book that could not be more timely, a book called The Selma Campaign, Martin Luther King Jr., Jimmie Lee Jackson, and the Defining Struggle of the Civil Rights Era. As many of you know, we are coming up on the 50th anniversary of those dramatic events in Selma, Alabama, in 1965, which helped lead to passage of the Voting Rights Act. And of course, these are also events immortalized in a highly regarded film called Selma that I'm sure many of you either know about or perhaps have even seen. And in anticipation of the events of 50 years ago, Craig Swanson is actually heading down to Selma, Alabama, to be part of a special 50th anniversary celebration and commemoration there. First of all, Craig Swanson, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. Great to be here.
Been too long. And although we're sort of getting ahead of ourselves in some ways, tell us about your trip down to Selma, exactly when that's going to happen and what is planned to occur in Selma.
Well, as you mentioned, it's the 50th anniversary. It's called the Bridge Crossing Jubilee. There'll be all kinds of dignitaries there, literally tens of thousands of people descending on this small southern town. There will be workshops, presentations, dinners, various functions. There will be a reenactment of the actual bridge crossing of 50 years ago itself. My wife and I and two friends are actually leaving on Wednesday. We'll be down there through Sunday, and really looking forward to it. I did a couple of visits to Selma researching my book, met some wonderful people, made some good friends, looking forward to seeing them again. And it's just a chance for us to be a small part of history, if you will, to help commemorate an event that really stands as one of the most significant in the history of our country. Hmm.
You were telling me before we went on the air that the writing of this book, the Selma Campaign, is tied very closely to the previous book that I mentioned, Something in the Air, which focuses on rock music and very important events that were going on within rock music and pop music in the critical years of 1965 and 66. Were you writing these books, in a sense, simultaneously, or did one serve as a catalyst for the other? I mean, what is their relationship?
Well, they're both books from the 60s, mid-60s. And in terms of writing or thinking about them simultaneously, I suppose I've been researching or writing each of them in my head for the past 30 or 40 years. But in terms of actually sitting down and putting pen to paper, as it were, I had begun work on the music book several years ago. At the same time, wanted to do something a little more substantive. The music book didn't require much reporting. It was a lot of personal anecdotes and observations and analysis and things like that. I wanted to dig a little deeper and do something more, as I mentioned, a little more significant, a little more substantial. And that's when I decided to pursue the Selma project. So as I was finishing the first book, I had actually begun work on the second one. Hmm.
So how old were you when these events unfolded in Selma? And what impact did they have on you personally at the time?
I would have been about 12 or 13 years old. And at the time, I'm sure I didn't recognize the tremendous significance, the impact of what was occurring, but I knew something important was happening. Hmm. I remember my parents talking about it in hushed tones. I remember the grainy black and white television images of the beatings and the violence that occurred in Selma, and was moved by it probably in some subconscious emotional sense as opposed to an intellectual sense. But I've always been fascinated with issues of race, of relationships between the races, and was thus fascinated by the civil rights movement, and have followed it closely over the years.
Hmm. Let's talk actually just for a moment, if we could, about the other book, the book which talks about the turbulence in the music world of the 1965 and 1966, really critical years, and I think that's going to kind of serve nicely as a segue into some of the specifics we want to explore in your book, The Selma Campaign. But Something in the Air, you talk about in very specific fashion about what was going on in the world of music in these critical years of 1965 and 1966 that really changed all kinds of things in ways that probably weren't even fully recognized at the time.
Right. Well, the premise of that book was that I took the premise or advanced a theory that 65 and 66 were the two most important years in the development of rock music. As I state in the book, they're the years that rock music morphed from a teen curiosity into a serious art form. And I phrase it another way, it's the 2 years that served as the bridge from Love Me Do to Sgt. Pepper. Without those 2 years, we wouldn't have gotten to Sgt. Pepper or Jimi Hendrix's Purple Haze or The Who's Tommy. it would have continued to have been the boy meets girl, boy loses girl, the simple pop songs of the late 50s, early 60s. The music wrought so many changes and were part of the cultural milieu of the time that I had to weave in what was also transpiring during that era, which included things such as the escalation of the war in Vietnam and the advances in civil rights and the coming of the civil rights era. So like you said, it was a natural once I had tied these pieces together under the umbrella of the rock music banner that I proceeded to explore one of those other issues, which was the civil rights movement. Mm.
One of the things that, of course, is a little hard for us to understand now all these years later is the fact that some very important things had already occurred in the civil rights era with the events of the late 1950s and the dramatic march on Washington in 1963, Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech, and then, of course, ultimately the next year, the passing of the Civil Rights Act. I mean, I think for a typical young student reading about this era, they could be forgiven for jumping to the conclusion that by 1965, things should have been real good, and there shouldn't have been much of any hard work yet to be done in the civil rights era. And yet, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, in some ways, a lot of the hardest work remained to be done. Sort of explain what was sort of the undone business of the civil rights era as we enter the year 1965.
Well, the undone business was actually implementing and making to function the reforms that had been passed, the laws that had been passed. There were now, by late 65, there were laws on the books prohibiting discrimination from public facilities, public accommodations, prohibiting county officials from imposing roadblocks, preventing the right to vote. These things were being addressed in a legislative manner. There were laws on the books, but they really weren't being implemented. And the struggle then until now has been to enforce these laws, to tackle racism that has popped up in other forms, institutional racism, things of that nature, which continue to bubble, if not on the surface, just beneath the surface. So it's been a long, hard struggle. There have been some major victories, but it's an issue that continues to plague us. Hmm.
Tell us about why Selma, Alabama, ended up being sort of a focal point of these dramatic events from a half century ago.
Well, Selma was a focal point. It's very interesting. Selma was both the height, the apex of the civil rights movement, as well as the beginning of the end. Hmm. Selma, by eliminating the obstacles to voting, such as the poll tax, the literacy tests, these things that the Southern officials would impose to prevent blacks from voting, the eliminating of those obstacles was a huge advancement. As Martin Luther King explained, this wasn't the black community getting the right to sit in the bus station. This wasn't a simple accommodation. This was preserving and protecting their right to vote, which is the beginning of all freedoms. Mm. Without that right to vote, they could effect no significant change. So obtaining that right to vote was absolutely critical.
And it probably helps explain why there was such fierce resistance to it, because
absolutely.
That meant something entirely different than just letting someone sit at a counter and drink coffee next to you. This was the kind of change that could ultimately change life as they knew it.
The white Southerners knew that they were giving them the right to vote would severely impact life as they knew it, their entire economic structure, the social structure of the South, which is why they fought it so vigorously. Unfortunately, such animosities broke out during the 65 voting rights campaign within the movement leadership. The more Martin Luther King followers were more conservative, willing to work through the system. There were others who were more animated, who wished to pursue more aggressively these issues of importance. And it kind of came to a head where when they were finally successful, they didn't know where to turn. One faction split off and followed Martin Luther King north. The others stayed behind to fight other battles. And it kind of signaled an end to the movement as it was known to that point.
Hmm. You write in your book, from the beginning, the ambitious voting rights campaign was complicated not just by white opposition or presidential politics, but also by growing fissures within the civil rights movement itself.
Right.
And then you go on in particular to explain the activity of two different organizations, one of them the SCLC. Is that the Southern Christian Leadership Conference?
Yes.
And then the other, known as SNCC, S-N-C-C. I don't remember what that stands.
Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee.
Of course. And I don't remember if it's in your book or someplace else. I read that Andrew Young, a very well-known, I think it is in your book, that you quote Andrew Young as saying that these two organizations were a little like me and my little brother. We love each other, but we don't get along very well. We fight constantly. And
well, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was Martin King's organization. And their approach to effecting social change was kind of top-down oriented. It was built much on King's personality and ability to attract media attention, and they would stage demonstrations, and they would focus on these issues and hopefully force the politicians to focus on these issues, and eventually change would emanate from throughout the system. SNCC's approach was much more low-key, much more egalitarian, where they would go into a community and quietly work behind the scenes trying to get people to register to vote, train them how to fill out forms, things of that nature. So although they had the same goal, they were two very different approaches. And some jealousies would emerge when SNCC would have spent 3 or 4 years in a community, as in fact they did in Selma, and then King's leadership conference would come in, and the reporters would follow them with the television cameras, and he would be on the news every night. And a certain amount of, as I said, jealousy would occur, and there were divisions to the point that after the Selma campaign, the two could no longer effectively work together.
Wow. From your perspective, I mean, certainly as an outsider looking in and a whole half century later, do you feel like is your impression that the civil rights movement needed both of these approaches, or was there one approach that really was much more effective than the other?
That's a great question. I don't know that I've ever really considered that. I think the they were sorting it out as they went. This was brand new, and King, of course, had enormous success with the Montgomery bus boycott of the 1950s, and he was a natural leader. And by all accounts, for all my research, he was a transcendent leader, almost magical in a sense. He was the face of the movement. He was the embodiment of the movement. The movement needed him. But I think, you know, thinking about it, there's also something to say for the SNCC, the student committee's approach, where they were more hands-on, less publicity-oriented, where they actually roll up their sleeves, get in the community, get their hands dirty, and try to do that foundational work. So I think one could argue in that sense that they were both necessary.
Right, and it's interesting to think about if all of this would have ultimately come to pass if they hadn't both been working from, in a sense, opposite directions, eventually meeting in the middle, in a sense.
Right.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Craig Swanson, well-known here in the area as a former editor of the Kenosha News, now the author of two books, and the one we're really talking about today is called The Selma Campaign, Martin Luther King Jr., Jimmie Lee Jackson, and the Defining Struggle of the Civil Rights Era. You might have heard about a recent event which occurred at Andrea's Bookstore, a book signing involving Craig Swanson and his outstanding book. The quote that I read from your book earlier talked about how this voting rights campaign was complicated by this internal struggle or internal division within the civil rights community itself. There was, of course, as we've also talked about, very entrenched, tenacious opposition by most whites in the South. And the quote also mentions presidential politics. That's probably something that we should talk about a little bit. Let's talk about the role that President Johnson played, not so much right as this was occurring in 1965, but leading up to it. In what way was President Johnson both an essential help, but also in some respects maybe a hindrance, or in some ways a slightly reluctant partner in bringing this change about?
Well, in researching the book, that's one of the things that I discovered that I never fully appreciated before. Johnson was a fascinating character, an amazing politician, an amazing person. He was also a very complicated person. Hmm. And he both had great designs. I showed great support for the movement. He also had personal proclivities that one would not attach to somebody so supportive of the movement. He was not afraid of throwing around the N-word. He, during his tenure in Congress, never supported a single civil rights piece of legislation. He was from the hill country of Texas, kind of the far western edge of the Confederacy, and as such was, I suppose, beholden to his constituents, in that he couldn't appear to be an overt integrationist. Hmm. He was sensitive to that. He was politically astute, of course. But once he was vice president and then president, he shed all that and pretty much became a prominent civil rights advocate. And I should mention that even when he was in the Senate and in the House, although he didn't support civil rights legislation, he never campaigned against integration. He never portrayed himself as a segregationist. In other words, I think he had, again, all along these inclinations that he was predisposed towards more integration, yet politically couldn't reveal that. Once in office, he really took on civil rights as one of his priorities. And very interesting, the relationship between he and Dr. King. From what I could gather from my research, they respected one another. They trusted one another to a degree. There was some wariness, of course. He did not move as quickly as the movement leaders would have liked. He, of course, had political concerns about when to bring forth this legislation. He had some concerns that it would conflict with some of his other great society programs and bills that were being introduced. But by and large, he emerged as a real champion of the civil rights movement. And the embodiment of that was the speech he gave following the bloodshed in Selma, when he announced his voting rights legislation, not in a press release or in a press conference, but to a joint session of Congress, which had only been done once before in history. And the speech was famous for its intensity, for its boldness, but primarily for the line he used in the middle of that speech where he said, "We shall overcome." Mm. He, in fact, co-opted the language, the slogan of the civil rights movement, took it on as his own, and in effect showed his solidarity with the movement. That was kind of the turning point of the entire campaign. Mm.
And again, this is a joint session of Congress that was televised. So
yes.
Many, many Americans saw this, and it had to have a very powerful impact in a way that probably otherwise maybe not would not have had.
Oh, it was. I've seen clips of that film. I watched it many times, and it is very dramatic, very powerful. They say that Dr. King had tears in his eyes watching it. Many of the other movement leaders were moved to tears. They were rejoicing. But nothing can ever be perfect, of course. And after that speech and the praise that Johnson was receiving, there began to be a little bit of a concern within the movement that he had almost gone too far, that he had, the leadership of the movement had now passed from Martin Luther King and his colleagues to the white president of the United States.
Mm.
So while everybody wanted his support, of course, there was a little concern that maybe the movement leaders were losing control of their own movement.
Huh. I don't want to spend too much time at this point talking about this, but I just want to issue a brief question about the film Selma, which you told me you have seen.
Yes.
And for the most part really enjoyed and admired. If there's been any point of special contentiousness or if there's a way in which this film has been criticized in terms of its accuracy or inaccuracy, it has to do with the way that President Johnson is portrayed in the film. Can you just say a quick word about that and your sense of how accurate or inaccurate that portrayal, in fact, is?
Yeah, well, I found the film very powerful, very moving, and very enjoyable. I do think that President Johnson was treated unfairly. I wouldn't presume to put myself in the shoes of the director or ascribe motives or anything of that sort. But Johnson was portrayed during the film as being very anti-movement, of colluding with the segregationist forces, of not really wanting to advance the cause of civil rights, which is patently untrue. Hmm. Now, one could, as I mentioned, the segregationist past and reluctance to move real quickly on some things, one could, I suppose, say that suggested he really wasn't in support of their goals. And that's subject to interpretation. But where I think the film was seriously flawed is when it portrayed President Johnson as colluding with J. Edgar Hoover from the FBI in attempting to blackmail Martin Luther King. There's no doubt that Hoover was engaged in such activity. There's absolutely no evidence that President Johnson knew of it, condoned it in any sense. In fact, I would be surprised to discover that he had. I'm sure he didn't. So that seemed to me to take it a step too far in showing the president actively plotting against the gentleman and the movement that he publicly was supporting. I think that went too far.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Craig Swanson about his book, The Selma Campaign, Martin Luther King Jr., Jimmie Lee Jackson, and the Defining Struggle of the Civil Rights Era. Everybody knows the name Martin Luther King Jr. Very few people know the name Jimmie Lee Jackson. And he never, of course, marched in Selma as part of this campaign. And yet his name is in the title of your book because of the tragic end of his life a little earlier in 1965. Tell our listeners who Jimmie Lee Jackson was and why he is such an important figure in the Selma campaign.
I get asked that question frequently, and I respond by saying Jimmie Lee Jackson is the most prominent civil rights figure that you've never heard of.
Hmm.
I will try to be brief. It gets a little complicated. Jimmie Lee Jackson was a young man, 27 years old, young black man, living in Marion, Alabama, which is about 30 miles from Selma. He was a martyr. He was killed during a civil rights protest in Marion, shot by a state trooper. It was his death that led directly to the Selma March to Montgomery, and which led to the violence at the bridge. Jimmie Lee Jackson, by all accounts, was a honest, hardworking young man. He had registered to vote several times, but had never been approved, so he was in tune with the movement. But interestingly, he was not a part of the movement. He didn't participate in the marches in Marion. He was not part of any active protests or demonstrations. He kind of stayed on the sidelines. He would drive his elderly grandfather to the protests. He would take his mother and his sister to the protests. But he himself never got engaged, perhaps because he was working several jobs and was trying to support a very poor family. So it's interesting that he, on the night of a police riot in Marion, where they broke up a demonstration. He was the individual who ended up getting shot. He wasn't even participating in the demonstration. He was there to pick up his mother.
Hmm.
And after, as the police were descending on these protesters, Jimmie Lee Jackson, his mother, and others ran for shelter in a nearby cafe. It was then that the police officers broke in. One of them grabbed his mother and threw her to the floor. And rushing to protect his mother, he grabbed a police officer, who then turned around and shot him twice.
Hmm.
It was that shooting, that death, that spurred movement leaders to realize that they had to demonstrate somehow more forcefully, in a more meaningful fashion, to bring attention to their cause. And that's when Dr. King and his associates came up with the notion of the Selma to Montgomery March.
Hmm. And I don't remember if it was in your book or elsewhere I read that it was also thought to be, in a sense, as a way to both diffuse and refocus the anger over that particular murder. That if there hadn't been some way to constructively direct that rage, it could have exploded in some really terrible ways.
Right, and I'm not sure if that was actually the case at the time or if that's some after-the-fact aggrandizement. I'm not sure.
Right.
But after the fact, several of the movement leaders suggested that calling further attention to their cause, they had to find an outlet for all this swelling anger and resentment that people were feeling. And one way to get them to release some of that anger was to stage a march and let them vocalize their concerns and express them in a very, very public yet nonviolent manner.
Hmm. The actual marches in Selma, there are actually several of them.
Yes.
And that in and of itself sort of points to what a complex matter this was and why you characterize it as the Selma campaign. It wasn't just one day, it wasn't just one march. And it begins on the 7th of March with an event which is sometimes known as Bloody Sunday.
Right.
Tell us exactly what happened on the 7th of March.
Well, this was the first march organized in response to Jimmie Lee Jackson's death. There were about 600 marchers left the Baptist Church where it was King's headquarters in Selma. Martin King was not a part of this march. He was in Atlanta at the time, tending to his own church, some functions at his own church. The march was led by John Lewis from the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and Hosea Williams from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. They stepped off. The march was supposed to get underway at 1 o'clock. I think they finally stepped off about 4 p.m. and were crossing the Pettus Bridge just outside of Selma, heading east towards Montgomery. When they reached the crest of the bridge, a big arcing structure, they saw before them a sea of blue. State police cruisers, state police troopers, deputized citizens, with tear gas masks, billy clubs, cattle prods, whatever. They approached the blue line and stopped. And for a moment, there was a face-off between these 600 marchers and this huge phalanx of police officers and posse men. The commander of the police forces, Lieutenant Major McLeod, I think his name was, said, "Halt. This is an illegal march. If you go any further, you will be arrested." John Lewis said, "Maybe we have a word with the major." Major Cloud said, "There is no word to be had. Hmm. You have 2 minutes to disperse." John Lewis at the time said, "We didn't know what to do. Here was a standoff." He said, "The only thing that you could think of was kneel and pray." So they got down on their knees. The line, the 600 people behind them, followed in concert. And after 1 minute, Major Cloud shouted the immortal words, "Troopers, advance." And the troopers, as one, as a unit, formed a wedge and plowed into the crowd of marchers, many of the troopers on horseback. And for 20 minutes, it was a scene of utter chaos and violence with beatings, clubbings, tear gassing, a horrendous scene. John Lewis himself suffered a fractured skull. Many of the women marchers were beaten, bloodied, beaten to the ground. Chaos ensued as they tried to scramble back across the bridge. The troopers followed them on horseback, beating them as they ran. So that was the probably the turning point of the civil rights movement. This happened in public, of course. The television cameras were running. As the newscast came on that night and people across America saw these images of these innocent people seeking nothing more than their constitutional right to vote, were being brutally beaten by the hands of the Alabama police establishment, that America turned against the South, as it were. Mm.
One of the things I find so, I was going to say ironic, I'm not sure that's quite the word, but it is so interesting to think about how the hatred and intense bigotry of certain leaders blinded them to the fact, or seemingly blinded them to the fact, that the actions they would carry out that day would ultimately have such a devastating effect to themselves and to the way of life that they were so anxious to protect, that if they had only shown more wisdom and compassion and restraint in that moment, all of this might have played out very, very differently. And instead, they let sort of their, in a sense, the darker angels of their nature carry the day, and their actions help set in motion events over which they could not possibly have any control.
That's right. In retrospect, of course, they were unaware of how this would play on a national stage. They knew how it would play locally or regionally.
Ah.
They knew that they would have support from their media constituents. I don't think they had any idea how this would be viewed in a larger national sense, the disgust with which so many people would view this.
Mm. In the wake of this comes a second march, very, very soon after, on the heels of this first one. Tell us about that.
2 days later, the march is called Turnaround Tuesday, and it was one of the low points of the campaign. After the events of Bloody Sunday, Dr. King returned to town. Emotions were running high. People were talking about revenge, violent revenge. To his credit, Dr. King and the others calmed them down, remained steadfast to their nonviolent approach, but something obviously had to be done. While his inner council was debating what approach to take, Dr. King made a public pronouncement that there would be an immediate follow-up march, that they would follow through on this. His advisors were unaware of this. He made an emotional comment during a rally, and they then had to find some way to follow through on it. So he announced that this march was going to take place in 2 days, and they had to scramble to try to pull the logistics together. And Dr. King realized he had gone too far, that he didn't know if they'd be able to pull this off or not, and he didn't want to expose the people to more violence. So they negotiated a settlement, the movement camp and the state authorities. The agreement was that Dr. King would take the group to the other side of the bridge where the violence had occurred. The state authorities would meet them there. Dr. King and his group would pray, and then they would turn back. Now, after Bloody Sunday, many people from across the country, black and white, blue collar, white collar, young and old, whatever, came to Alabama, to Selma, in support of the marchers. So from Sunday to Tuesday, the march had swelled from 600 people to 2,000 to 3,000 people, all of whom thought they were going to march from Selma to Montgomery, or at least be confronted and have a chance to confront this bigotry. They felt sold out, because when the march started and they got to the point where the initial violence had occurred, instead of standing their ground like the troopers said they were going to do and forcing King to turn back, they opened up. They opened up a path that would have been a straight shot through to Montgomery for Dr. King. He didn't want to do that. By doing that, he would have been in violation of a federal court order that had been handed down on Monday, preventing further marches because of the prospect for further violence. So all of a sudden, King was forced with a choice of violating a court order, federal injunction, or looking weak and turning back. He chose to turn back, which in retrospect was the right approach, but at the time seemed to many of his supporters as being a sellout and showing a sign of weakness. He was roundly criticized for that, and in fact that was probably the most significant development in the split between the two civil rights organizations.
And in the immediate wake of that march, which essentially occurred without incident, there is another murder, I believe.
Yes, a group of three white ministers from the Boston area who had traveled to Selma to participate in the second march were having dinner that night at a small cafe in the black part of Selma. And they discussed the day's events and wondered what was going to happen next and such. As they left the cafe, they were confronted by four white youths, each carrying a 2x4. And while they tried to walk past them without incident, they were confronted, beaten. One of the ministers, James Reeb, a young man, was knocked to the ground, beaten over the head, and died several days later at a hospital in Birmingham of his injuries.
It is all of that which helps ultimately bring this to the critical point in which President Johnson, of course, is prompted to go on national television with that joint session of Congress and declare his very emphatic support for a Voting Rights Act, which would help safeguard the constitutionally guaranteed right of all Americans, including blacks in the South, to vote.
Right.
And ultimately, there is yet another march, a third and final march, which I believe occurs on the 21st of March. Tell us what made this march different from the two which had preceded it.
Well, by this time, the injunction had been lifted. The arguments had been aired before a judge in Montgomery. He approved the right to march. He ordered the state of Alabama to provide protection for the marchers. King and his associates had 2 weeks to plan the march, work out the logistics, do it in an orderly manner. So this final march was not a spontaneous reaction to developments. It was legally authorized. It was well planned. There was a purpose in mind, and it went off very smoothly. Several thousand people left Selma. By the time they got to Montgomery, it was 5 or 6 days later. They would camp along the roadsides. While Governor Wallace refused to support or protect the marchers, claiming his state National Guard and state troopers would be spread too thin, that gave Lyndon Johnson the opportunity to federalize the National Guard of Alabama, plus send in additional troops. So there were military helicopters flying overhead. There were National Guardsmen stationed all along the route, so it was very well organized, very well protected. By the time they got to Montgomery, they were some 25 to 30,000 strong. They'd picked up people along the way. People flew in from across the nation, celebrities, Harry Belafonte, Sammy Davis Jr., the list goes on. Political notables were there. It was a grand entrance to Montgomery, to the steps of the state capitol, where King made another notable speech. Rumor has it that Governor Wallace could be seen in his office just on the block peering through his pulled blinds on the window. I don't know if that's true or not. But, again, the absolute highlight of the civil rights campaign.
We mentioned that the film Selma is in many quarters highly regarded, but not fully accurate. We just have a couple of minutes, but could you just say a word about maybe the ways in which they are not quite true to the historic record, but in other ways in which this film makes a very powerful statement about what occurred 50 years ago?
Well, I think the film is essentially accurate. It captures the power of the movement. It captures the emotions of the time. It reflects the significance of what was occurring. As I mentioned earlier, the biggest thing is I think President Johnson was done a disservice by the implication that he was conspiring with Edgar Hoover. Other than that, there are a number of small things that I would quibble with. I suppose you would attribute them to creative license. For instance, they greatly condensed this long story I've been telling, perhaps for obvious reasons. They made it look like there was Jimmie Lee Jackson was shot, and then there was a march, when in fact there was virtually 2 months worth of march, 60 days worth of protests and marches and demonstrations leading up to this. It was a very long, hard-fought campaign. They also papered over or ran through the Jimmie Lee Jackson shooting. They implied that it occurred right in Selma and that he had died that night, when in fact the shooting occurred in Marion. He didn't die for 8 days after that. Hmm. So they took a lot of the things and eliminated some of the less active times between these events, compacted it and turned it into a more of a tidy story, I suppose.
Right, yeah. I guess I can understand how that would be done. I do know that one of the things they depict with disturbing realism is the kind of barriers that blacks faced in a place like Selma when they would go and attempt to register to vote, the kind of questions that would be posed to them that that made it all but impossible for really anybody to be allowed to vote.
Oh, it was absurd. And the folks that I talked to in Selma would tell those stories. They would get tears in their eyes. At this distant remove, they could talk about some of them at least with a ironic sense of humor. One elderly gentleman said, "The questions on those tests, you need a Philadelphia lawyer to help you figure out some of those answers." And it was really remarkable, the humiliation and the literally the abuse that they would have to put up with simply for trying to register to vote. In this day and age, it seems inconceivable. But this was during many of our lifetimes. This is not some tale from eons ago. This is relatively recent history, and it's hard to imagine that today.
Absolutely. I mean, in the grand scope of things, it's practically yesterday.
Right.
And I suppose you're grateful for the fact that that there were so many people that you were able to speak with who were directly a part of these events one way or another. I mean, if you had waited 20 years to write this book, it would have been a whole another experience.
Right. One gentleman showed me the scar he had on the back of his head. He said he was clubbed, actually, in Marion, coming out of the cafe the night Jimmie Lee Jackson was shot. He got clubbed. And he managed to stagger home, and his wife, who happened to be a registered nurse, patched him up. But one of the first things he did was show me his scar. Hmm. 50 years later, and it's still one of the most important things in his life.
Wow. Well, we want to urge people who want to know more about these important events to seek out your book, which is called The Selma Campaign, Martin Luther King Jr., Jimmie Lee Jackson, and the Defining Struggle of the Civil Rights Era. And its author, Craig Swanson, also the author of Something in the Air, Rock Music and Cultural Upheaval in Mid-60s America. I hope we can have you back to talk about that book as well.
I'd love it.
Craig Swanson, thank you for joining us today on The Morning Show. I really appreciate it. And safe travels to Selma. Maybe we can have a follow-up conversation to hear a little bit about what you experienced down there.
That would be great. Thank you so much, Greg.
You're very welcome. We want to remind you that The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, WGTD.org. Click on Talk. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support also comes from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. It will be sunny and mild today. In fact, we'll warm up today to a balmy 27. Cloudy tonight, light snow after midnight, low of 21. Tomorrow, looks like a couple inches of snow and maybe some freezing rain and sleet as well, a high of 37.